This is Preston Dennett, and you are listening to the UFO Talker.
You are listening to the UFO Talker podcast. Come with us as we explore UFOs from the past and the present. With insightful discussions, interviews, and reviews, we will add our voice to the mysteries that have been seen in our skies and oceans for all of human history. Now, here's our host, Michael Ryan.
Welcome, everybody, to the podcast. This is episode 26 from Studio 7H here in Ontario, Canada. On today's episode, we have part two of the Preston Dennett interview, and we also have a book review by Christine Scott of Ross Coulthart's book, In Plain Sight. But before we get to that, I just wanted to mention that today was our first day of our 4 a.m. release time, which I mentioned last week that this would be the first Wednesday that we're starting our new release time. So instead of 5 a.m., it's 4 a.m. And I'm glad we have all recovered from the invasions of the balloons in the last week or so. That was the news everywhere. It was what everyone was talking about. And today I heard that the three balloons or whatever the objects were that were shot down, they have now given up any chance of finding them. So one of them that was shot down in the Yukon, that makes total sense because, you know, there are thousands and thousands of square miles of just totally rugged terrain. There's no people, there's no roads, there's nothing. So trying to find small bits of an object that got shot down would be extremely difficult, to say the least. I just want to take a brief moment to talk about an app that I got last week and to see if people out there have had the same experience that I had. So I have lots of old photos of my parents and grandparents, and some of them have been wrinkled a bit. I was looking around for software that would touch that up and make things look better, sharper, that kind of thing. So I found one in the app store that I thought, oh, this looks like it'll be pretty good. So I took a picture of the pictures with my phone, and I thought, wow, it did make it sharper. Not incredibly sharper, but, you know, it was sharper. And I thought, well, that was pretty good. And so then I noticed it had the software had taken the individual. There was four people in the picture, and this picture would have been from the 50s, I think. And it had taken all their faces and blown them up. And I thought, wow, those look clear for being able to zoom in so close to the faces, because they were kind of further away in the original photograph. And as I looked at the photos, I realized that in a lot of the people's faces, because, you know, it's my mom and dad and people I had known growing up, that they had different teeth, and sometimes they had different eyes than what I remembered. And I looked into it a bit, and then I realized, oh, the software is replacing the parts that were too blurry, like their teeth and their eyes, and it's just replacing it with, you know, a vast bank of teeth and eyes that it has stored away in its memory bank. And then the thought dawned on me, that is just horrible. I thought, that is defeating the purpose of all of this. And so I deleted the app. Luckily, it was a free trial, so I didn't have to pay for it. But I thought, just think of all the people who are not really aware of this kind of thing and just started doing their whole inventory of photos. You know, they're getting rid of tons of history. Like, that isn't really their loved ones anymore. It's a computer-generated version of their loved ones. And I thought, wow, that's terrible. Like, you just think, you know, technology and computers, you just think, oh, they're just making things better without giving it much thought. But when you kind of look into it, you're thinking, yeah, so that's not better. That was some guy's idea of this would be better, but yeah, no, that's not better. So if anyone knows of a software out there that just sharpens things up or makes things better without altering the reality, drop me a line and let me know what it is, because I'd be very interested. Also, today we have a very interesting moment in UFO history. I really enjoyed researching this one and looking everything up for it. And we'll be right back after this message.
The date was November 23rd, 1957. The time, after midnight. The place was Stead Air Force Base, Nevada. First Lieutenant Joseph F. Long had just finished packing his gear into his 1956 Chevrolet. He had just completed his survival training, and he was now about to begin his journey back to headquarters at the 97th Fighter Interceptor Squadron near Wilmington, Delaware. As he got behind the steering wheel, he pulled his jacket so it covered his neck. He was surprised the desert could get so cold at night. He liked driving at night, and there were lots of places to pull off to the side of the road and have a sleep if he got tired. With any luck, he should be driving into Tonopah, Nevada, around 7 a.m. First Lieutenant Joseph F. Long didn't know it then, but this would be a drive that he would remember for the rest of his life. It was first light. The sun would soon be over the mountain range. Joseph looked down at his watch. It was 6:30 a.m. Just then, the engine of his car began to sputter, and finally it stopped. The Chevy rolled to the side of the road. He tried to start the car again, but nothing. He couldn't see any other cars on the highway. As he got out of the car, he became aware of a high-pitched whining sound. As he turned to find the source of the sound, he was stunned by what he saw. About 400 yards from the road were four saucer-shaped craft resting on the desert floor. He could barely believe what he was seeing. He decided to take a closer look and started walking towards them. After a few minutes, he got within 50 feet of the disc-shaped objects. They all looked identical and were about 50 feet in diameter. They were all glowing brightly and had a transparent dome on the top. The UFOs were almost 15 feet tall. They all had a dark ring around the center, and it appeared to be rotating. As he tried to get closer, the high-pitched sound became louder, and all four UFOs lifted off and flew north until they disappeared over some hills. First Lieutenant Long quickly got back in his car, and it started on the first try. He rushed to the Indian Springs Air Force Base and made a full report. In the weeks that followed, the U.S. Air Force fully investigated the encounter. First Lieutenant Joseph F. Long was a highly educated, credible officer and was backed up by his commanding officer. The Tonopah sighting never made the headlines. The sighting was buried and written off as road fatigue. To this day, it remains as one of the best UFO encounters in the Air Force records.
And now for part two of the Preston Dennett interview. Another good case from your book is, and I'm hoping I'm pronouncing the guy's name correctly, is Paul Castardo. And he was part of a two-boat convoy. So this one is very, very unusual.
Yeah, this was pretty scary for the main witness. And again, this is a military guy. He was one of the submariners I interviewed. So a real good witness, and was actually in a convoy with two boats traveling north up the coast. This would be towards the northern end of all this activity, but I think still part of the whole complex here. I believe they were off the coast of San Simeon, and it was a stormy night, and the boat ahead of them lost power, and they were unable to reach the boat and lost all contact with it. And so they're on their own at this point when they see this massive, what he called a yellowish-orange light ahead of them and to the right, which was very puzzling because they knew this area. They knew there were no beacons or light buoys in this area. It was very close to the shore. but still in the water. And boats can't go there. Yeah. It's too shallow. There are rock hazards. And they could see this thing on radar. They had a fully equipped boat. And it was huge. She said it was about the size of a tanker. Maybe 100 feet offshore. So this made no sense to them. And so they're paying attention to it when suddenly they realize that their depth gauge shows 15 feet. They're a few miles offshore.
Yeah, that would be scary.
So they immediately had to take action and go deeper in towards the ocean, and became quite alarmed and had to divert their attention from the object to basically make sure that they were safe. And I find this very interesting because they had no sooner basically turned and went into deeper water, and this is when they realized that this object had moved. It was now 1 mile ahead of them, dead ahead. And this had only been a minute, maybe, right in front of them.
Wow.
So they basically had a face-off with this thing, and they stopped. They didn't do anything, and this object came right towards them, went to their port side, and it had lights all over it, lit up like stadium lights is how he described it. And he says, there's nothing. There is no kind of ocean craft that looked anything remotely like this. Mm. So they were really quite frightened by it. They couldn't see any shape. It was very close. He says, it was huge. Had to be about 600 feet across.
Wow. That would give you a pause for contemplation as you're sailing at night.
Yeah, and it stops right next to them. I mean, it was a good, 2 miles off, so not terribly close. But it was really unusual looking. Orangish lights, they were pulsating. They didn't stay like one constant intensity. They would go from light to dark and fluctuating. And just about 30 or 40 of these lights, no conventional lights, no portholes, no masthead lights, no running lights. And it was in view for well over, right as it stopped next to them, at least 5 or 10 minutes. And they could not identify this.
Hmm.
And it was a stormy night, very heavy swells. They were still in a fairly dangerous area. So they decided, you know what? We're uncomfortable. Let's just get out of here.
Yeah.
And they did. But yeah, he's convinced it was not anything normal, is how he put it.
There's, I want to touch on the military aspect of this area, because I believe that is fairly interesting. And as some of my listeners know, I actually grew up in Huntington Beach, California. So there is a naval weapons station there. It's called the Seal Beach Naval Weapons Station. And it's quite large. It's 5,256 acres. And they carry a lot of the Navy's ammunition there. And so growing up, it would just, when you drove by it, there would be large fences. And it just looked like mounds covered in dirt. So as a kid, I don't know if the adults knew what it was, but as a kid, we had no clue what was there. And if you looked on a map, because we used maps back then, that area was completely blank. So there'd be street names and everything. And then we got to that area and it was just white space. There was no comment on what it was. And I didn't find out till years later that they stored nuclear weapons there. And there's always a big connection between UFOs and nukes. And I was wondering if you had heard of any stories of UFOs in that area.
Well, it's up and down this whole area. I'm sure I have cases in the Huntington Beach area. I do know that Stephen Greer talked about a case specifically at Seal Beach, which, by the way, was the same month as Leland Hansen's sighting, April 1966, where the Saturn rocket was being, you know, constructed or worked on, and a UFO showed up, was viewed by some 40 people. They all saw it. But Huntington Beach does have some sightings. There was one, now that I think of it, 2004, where witnesses saw a glowing object traveling at about 4,000 feet overhead, and it actually ejected, they said, what looked like molten metal, which, you know, it did this 4, 5, 6 times as they watched it. And this is very unusual for UFO cases, but there's, I think, 2 or 3 at least in this area like that. And that's, yeah, I think there's at least 2 or 3 others that I know of that took place in Huntington Beach specifically. There was another one in 2009 from the shoreline. A witness saw this object, which he thought at first was a plane making a descent, but as he realized it coming closer, it had none of the navigation lights, made a banking turn and discharged what looked like these burning objects. And he finally got a good look at it, and he says it was silver, like brushed aluminum, and rounded. So I don't know. Very unusual looking object. There is a lot of military in this area. It's not just Seal Beach.
Yeah, because I guess in Long Beach, that is a huge Navy yard where a lot of ships are ported. And also there's an island there. This has always fascinated me, and perhaps you know more about it, is San Clemente Island. So it's an island that the Navy has owned since 1934. And I always think to myself, is it either possible that this base is looking for UFOs, or they're testing equipment that could be mistaken, some of them, for UFOs? Because a couple of interesting things is, so the public can't land on this island. There's signs everywhere, and you can't get closer than 300 yards. And it has 400 Navy personnel there at all times. And it used to be a large sonar listing base for underwater submarine warfare. And it also has, this is really interesting, is it's got a 9,300 foot long runway. And there's another island nearby called San Nicolas Island. It has a 10,000 foot runway. So these are fairly substantial runways for these small islands. And like, to give you a comparison, Edwards Air Force Base in California, which is well known for all kinds of experimental aircraft, it's got the largest runway, military runway in the world, 15,000 feet. So I always think, what are they doing on these islands? Because in intelligence, the motto is you can hide things in plain sight. And where else better to do some strange activity would be San Clemente Island. It's right there in the middle of millions of people, but you can't get on it, and it's out in the ocean.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that some of what people are seeing, and I'm going to underline that some,
yes, yeah,
it's probably military. And San Clemente, yeah, I mean, there, you can look this up on charts. And it warns of a magnetic disturbance there.
Yeah.
With differences as much as 5 degrees from normal, just 3 miles off the shore. Public is not allowed. There's all kinds of naval exercises going on there with submarines and the Navy SEALs. And there's also Port Hueneme, a naval base on the north end here. So this whole area is basically surrounded by military. However, this, you got to remember, this activity, this UFO, USO activity, reaches back to the 1920s,
yes,
really.
Yeah, before that.
And earlier. And the Navy was absolutely baffled by it. I mean, there's a case which took place in 1947 The Modern Age of UFOs, which is really quite interesting and telling, I think, and points towards this not being military, because there was this unknown, well, they called it a reef or a mysterious mountain that kept moving. This was actually up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and it was causing problems with shipping navigation. So the Navy sent a survey ship, the Maury, piloted by Captain Hambly, and found this thing and tracked it down off the coast of Southern California and got it on their depth sounders and everything for a short time. But eventually it did disappear. But whatever it is was quite large. And this is one early example of many in which the Navy are clearly baffled by what's going on here.
Yes. Well, it just makes me wonder that on San Clemente Island, like it's, you know, like you mentioned, they're using live ordnance. That would be another reason not to step foot on the island, because lots of live ordnance is being used. But that would be the perfect reason to do to do something there, where they were either trying to discover USOs or UFOs, or have some equipment, like you mentioned, it wouldn't be all of it, but some aircraft that could be potentially misidentified as a UFO.
Probably there's so many cases the Navy is chasing these in their aircraft and are absolutely baffled by what's going on. And I've talked to some of these officers who are like, no, we did not know what this is. It put us on high warning. It's not military. And there's a number of reasons why I don't think it's military. It's far too much activity. And it's very brazen.
Yes.
I mean, they're putting on displays, chasing cars down the road, hovering over people's homes, targeting boaters. This is not how the Navy tests secret aircraft.
You hope not. Also, just to give our listeners a perspective, so the area we're talking about, that is in the same area where the Tic Tac was seen by Commander Fravor. Like, it's not far from Catalina Island, actually.
Yeah, part of this whole complex of events. Like I said, you know, I've got 150 cases. Well, it's probably closer to 200 now. But I can tell you with absolute confidence that 1 in 100 people, really, and that's being generous, report this to any Air Force, police, UFO group. So you could times that easily by 10 safely, but 100. So we're talking thousands of reports over the years.
There is, in your book, there is a fascinating case. I think it could probably be a book on its own. And this was the in the summer of 1988, the photographer Kim Carlsberg, her encounter.
Ah, yeah. Well, she's got quite a few of them, actually.
Yes, yeah.
She was a professional photographer who worked on Baywatch and had a home in the Malibu area and started seeing UFOs and actually communicating with them sort of telepathically. At this point, she didn't quite realize what was going on here, but she saw this glowing object. And she was in absolute awe. And this thing, she says, as though it was responded to her thoughts, advanced and became this huge luminous sphere about 50 feet in diameter, just 100 feet away from her window. This was her first real big sighting. But she ended up having a lot more encounters and being taken on board craft and to what she believes might actually be an undersea or perhaps underground base, which is one of a number of witnesses who report this in this area. Wow. And this was one of the things that really led me to start looking into the possibility that this is more than just an area of heavy activity, but might have an actual base.
Yeah. There is a show, there's lots of UFO shows, of course, but to me, one of the very best UFO shows that you have a connection with is UFO Hunters. And that was I think Bill Burns was the kind of the lead on that show. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your experience for the, I think you were on episode 2 of that show. If you could tell us what that was like.
Yeah, that was really cool, actually, because I had been contacted by the History Channel earlier for their show, Deep Sea UFOs. And it was really successful. It beat out their highest rated show at the time, Ice Road Truckers. So they called me back for Deep Sea UFOs 2, which was also really successful. And I was able to bring on some witnesses to both those episodes, but they were so impressed that they called me back for their new show, UFO Hunters, which was very cool. And on that occasion, I was able to get some really good witnesses who finally got some airtime. Because a lot of what, you know, when they bring you on to do a TV show, they'll interview you for 3, 4, 5 hours, and you end up getting a minute or two.
Yeah.
If you're, I was quite disappointed with, you know, the handling of some of this, but I understand, you know, they only have so much time.
Yeah.
I was able to bring on for that show 3 separate witnesses who did get good airtime on the show. And I think began to give a better, more accurate presentation of the activity that's going on in this area.
What was you got to talk to Bill Burns, and I've always wondered, what was he like? Because he seems to have stepped back a little bit from ufology. He was deep into it. You know, he had the UFO magazine and UFO Hunters and some other things. But recently, I think he's not as active. I was wondering, what was your impression of Bill Burns?
Well, he was a nice guy, I'll say that. It was very interesting to meet him. He was quite prominent in the field. I had been published in the magazine that he headed before with the previous editors.
Mm-hmm.
I was glad to see that, you know, he kept it going for a little while. He's put out a few books. I talked to him about some of my own books, and he was very complimentary. He was a nice guy. It was really cool to meet him. I mean, that's about all I can really say.
To me, that show, UFO Hunters, I'm going to say it's one of the best shows that has been on. It always had a lot of facts in it. It was always well-produced. And it was interesting to hear your thoughts on what it was like to film those shows, because generally it's a small crew, right? It's not like a lot of people.
Yeah, well, they did actually rent a boat, and so we had the captain and the whole camera crew, and of course the crew who was involved with the show itself. Bill Burns and myself were the experts for, I think, that particular episode. It's interesting because the USOs in this area has attracted a lot of media attention, and I've done a number of shows. UFO Highways was one. I think the favorite of all I did was the show with Josh Gates.
Mm-hmm.
What's it called? Expedition X or something like that. Because they went out there and did active field work for 2 days and caught 3 remarkable incidents on film, which is really unusual to be that successful.
Yes. Yeah, to go out and actually, you know, we're going to film something today, that almost never happens.
And they did. The most impressive being this object, which was clearly not conventional, coming up out of the water straight up at high speeds and going off into, you know, the atmosphere or wherever they go. But yeah, you can actually see this on the show. They caught some underwater activity as well. Unexplained lights, had weird magnetic anomalies. There's been a lot of research into this area. A lot of shows have covered it, with or without me.
So on that episode 2, one of the witnesses that you brought, that they actually left off the show, but to me it could have been maybe the most interesting case, was the Jonathan Fox encounter, because that is just mystifying, because it involved a lot of people. And it is hard to say exactly what happened. Like, was there missing time, or what exactly happened?
I'll have to shorten this one, because honestly,
it's a very long story. Yes.
Yeah, we could spend an entire hour on just.
So if you could briefly describe what happened.
Yeah, this was the 4th of July weekend, interestingly enough, in 1982, when a group of 11 friends conducted their annual campout at Blackjack Campgrounds. This is located on Mount Orizaba, which is Catalina's tallest mountain, rising about 2,000 feet above sea level. It's got a great view. And these were all young, up-and-coming actors and writers and photographers and artists. One of them, Jonathan Fox. I ended up interviewing a couple of the other people there. But they had sort of a party, which they would do each 4th of July. And they would pick a theme. And E.T. having just come out, that was the theme, by coincidence. And so they brought lights and, you know, flashers and sort of called out to ETs. This is what we would call CE5 work.
Yeah.
Trying to initiate an encounter. But they were just kind of joking with it. They did not expect anything to happen, but it did. Lights came in. First it was one, and then it was three. They started flashing back at them. And then a whole display went on that really quite frightened some of them. I mean, one person became so frightened, she vomited. I mean, this was a big deal when these objects came swooping down and circling around them.
And this was over a few hours. This wasn't just like 5 minutes or 10 minutes. This was a while.
And what's very interesting about this case is, you know, the temperature dropped, you know, the fog rolled in. There was all kinds of weird effects. Mind you, they had cameras, pretty much all of them, but there were four professional photographers. And every single one of their cameras failed. All their watches stopped. Their flashlights wouldn't work. This is what we call electromagnetic effects. And there is no way this is a coincidence. It's just not possible. It's pretty clear to me that there was deeper levels of contact here, because there was physiological effects as well. It's a very long and involved case.
Do you know, because at the end of your book, you mentioned this, that one of the women went on to become a fairly big film star.
Yes, another became a sitcom star, and you would know their names. I guarantee you would.
Do you know their names?
I do.
And you're not going to tell us.
I cannot.
So the film star, we would definitely know her name. She is
a big
name. Because that makes it all the more fascinating. So I just on that alone, I can recommend picking up your book just for that story alone, because it's like Preston's mentioned, it's a lot more involved than what we've discussed here, but very chilling. I wonder, so in the time since your book, since 2018, has there been any other remarkable USO stories from that area?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They come in fairly regularly. It comes in waves, no pun intended. I do remember going on the Coast to Coast show with Art Bell. I believe it was Art Bell at the time. And someone called in. He's like, I'm so glad you talked about this, because I was there in my boat. This was on the Channel Islands area. And he saw what he thought were whales swimming beneath his boat. But there were a lot of them. And it kept happening. And so he's peering over the side looking, wondering what the heck these things are, because they don't look normal. And finally one comes up shallow enough where he can get a good look at it. It's gray, it's metallic, it's round, it's not a whale.
That's right.
Craft. That was, actually, I think I did include that in the book. Now that I think about it, I'd have to check. But that was, you know, this was a book I had never really intended to write, and kind of got pulled into it because people kept asking me to speak on this subject on the radio, at conventions, eventually on television. And I had collected so many of these cases. But yeah, I am still contacted by people who tell me it gets somewhat repetitive, honestly. people are on the shore there and they see these glowing objects darting around at high speeds, coming up out of the water, going in, rarely both. But
it's funny that, so I have known about USOs for a long time, but it is, seems to be a smaller segment of this phenomenon. You don't, at least you don't hear about it as much. So like you're saying, your book and the Sanderson book, those are the only two that I can think of that like the entire book is about it. It's, and when you think of it, in the Commander Fravor encounter, the Tic Tac, so originally that's what they saw. They saw something under, just under the surface. People kind of don't remember that part of it, right? That when they looked down, they saw something that looked like a commercial airliner just kind of under the surface churning up the water.
Yeah, it's amazing how many reports there are, and so many more coming out. Some of the reports I have involve not one or two objects either, or even 10 or 20, but we're talking 50, or in a couple of cases, 100, 200.
Wow.
So this is what another sort of data point that led me to believe that there is something very special about this area, something that is attracting these in large numbers. I don't know exactly what's going on. I mean, I can only speculate that there might be a base, but the fact that there's four witnesses, five at last count, because I did get a new one of people reporting being taken into some area that is not your standard UFO craft, you know, with rounded walls and a small room and so forth. So hard to say for sure, but I can tell you this area
it's is funny, very like, like you mentioned, like you've been to Catalina Island. I've been to Catalina Island several times. And for people who don't know the area, so when you go to Catalina Island, it is a totally different vibe than Southern California. It's almost like you're not 26 miles away, you're 10,000 miles away. And it definitely has a vibe and a feeling that is quite different. I don't want to get mystical, but it is, you feel different when you're there. There is a different feeling. It's hard to describe.
Yeah, and by the way, the locals know all about the UFO, USO activity. There's a guy who gives tours. The guy who runs the newspaper there, or writes articles for it, is very well aware of all the activity. I've corresponded with him. It's very well known among the locals.
Just before we wrap this up, I want to mention that I will post a link to Preston's website in the show notes, and it's a very elaborate website, lots of great information there, and I would highly recommend picking up his book that we just discussed. It is very interesting and, you know, goes into a lot more detail than what we have discussed here. So, Preston, thank you very much for your time. It's been fascinating.
Hey, a true pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show. Much appreciated.
It's time once again for a book review from Christine Scott. Christine has written for Prairie Dog Magazine, Cracked, and Home Movies Magazine, and she is the co-owner of Centennial Books in Regina, Saskatchewan. Chris, what book do you have for us today?
Well, today I have a very enthusiastic recommend. It's the book by Ross Coulthart called In Plain Sight, An Investigation into UFOs and Impossible Science, published by HarperCollins in 2021. So it's fairly recent, 344 pages, including lots of footnotes, lots of footnotes.
We love footnotes.
We do.
Yes.
And he also has a lot of great photos. But the first I'm going to go into a bit about Ross. I'm going to say off the top, if he speaks, you listen.
Yes. he has some street cred.
He does. He's Australian. He works for the current affairs program, 60 Minutes, and Sunday Night there. And he's won 5 Walkley Journalism Awards, including the top one for Australian journalism called the Gold Walkley. And, you know, a lot of people think people writing about UFOs are cranks. But Russ is also affiliated with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, which, oh, I don't know if you've heard of them. They did a little thing called the Panama Papers.
Yes, yeah.
So I can't recommend this book enough. If someone came to me and said, Chris, I know nothing about UFOs. You own a bookstore. What should I start with? I would say pick up In Plain Sight, because it's not just very well written. It's like the greatest hits of UFO research.
Well, that's what everyone who I've spoke to, that's what they're all saying, is that if you weren't really knowledgeable about UFOs or kind of its history, they said this book is going to bring you up to speed.
It will, and it's also very readable. Someone who knows a lot about UFOs can pick it up, or nothing about UFOs. And, you know, like a lot of people, he started out being interested as a teenager in New Zealand, hearing, you know, UFO reports. And I'm sure a lot of people would guess this, but Australia Aboriginal rock art has a rich history of depicting alien faces. It's, you know, the thing you see in a lot of First Nations cultures when you see the rock art. And of course, Chariots of the Gods went nuts over this. Mm-hmm. But Australia has a history of these odd depictions of things in the skies and strange faces. And there was something in Australia called the Min Min Lights, right back to the 19th century period of early European settlement. So, you know, he, as a teenager, became interested in all this stuff. And there was a mystery aircraft flap, unquote, from the 30s. And the British aviator Francis Chichester, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, started reporting stuff. And when he looked into it as a youngster, and of course as a journalist, he realized Australians got all the same explanations too. You know, oh, it's Venus, it's a balloon. And he just realized, you know, the parallels with all the famous sightings from around the world, the explanations didn't really help anyone.
Well, I've seen him quoted on some show where he was talking to some, I think he was doing a video report, this was a while ago, on some Australian Air Force pilots who had seen some UFOs. And so he kind of was looking into it, and then he seemed to back away from it. But then these 3 or 4 pilots had gone to him privately, and they said, no, you should still look into this, because we know there's something to this. And he kind of said, okay, so if these guys are kind of coming back to me and saying there's definitely something here, and that was kind of almost a turning point for him. I think I either heard him say this or I read it somewhere.
Well, and another thing, because I recently reviewed the Grant Cameron book about how our UFOs piloted, this is an area of interest for him too. And the name of Canadian Wilbert Smith came up again, you know, the guy who sent the memo saying, what's up with UFOs? Yes. How do we fly them?
Yeah.
So this is coming up with him too. And someone, I think we, you know, he's asking, is the secrecy because governments are trying to crack the propulsion systems? And I think it sometime in the future, that it's, you know, not enough time to go into this. A lot of people refer back to the Pentagon funding to American Robert Bigelow, Bigelow Aerospace, with advanced space studies, wondering, what is he being paid to look into?
Yes. And then also, I think he got that, Bigelow got that contract in kind of an unusual way. I don't think they tendered it.
No.
Somehow he ended, you know, he was friends with Reed.
Yeah.
In Congress.
Yeah.
And somehow he ended up with the contract.
Yeah.
How did that happen? Wow.
Yeah. And see, that's a whole separate subject for us. I think one day it would be great to do an episode about that. Without spoiling too much about the book, that's another very important aspect of what he's investigating. And, you know, it's, again, when people say you know, UFO writers are cranks. He's also, as I said, he's won awards. He's investigated Australian crime. He's a follow the money guy,
yes,
essentially, in his writing. So
and he's on, like you mentioned, he's on Australian 60 Minutes.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a prestige, you know, spot.
Yeah. I would give it 5 out of 5 discs.
Nice.
Automatically. Yeah. It's such a good read. And it's for the casual reader. It's for the person who thinks they know everything about UFOs. You know, go ahead. Have a look. There's probably something in here you've never heard of before.
And then also something that's kind of good is he has a YouTube channel called Need to Know.
Oh, okay.
And it's his friend Bryce Zabel. And that is interesting as well. They kind of made friends through the pandemic. Bryce is an American. And they made friends through the pandemic, and they just did Zoom, you know, calls for their podcast. Mm-hmm. And then they eventually met, and they did this YouTube channel. So it has a lot of great, great information on it.
Oh, I'll have to look at that. Yeah, I'm quite interested also, because I love reading stuff like this, to read his, you know, books on Australian crime. And as I said, anything, he's a follow the money guy. Mm-hmm. And I love reading anything like that. And for that reason, too, this book would also appeal to people who maybe don't care about UFOs, but they're wondering about government secrecy. Because after Watergate and the Vietnam War, you know, people started saying, well, should we believe the government about things?
Yes. Yeah.
And public trust eroded. And since then, there's been more pressure on the military to explain things. So he's going to, I think, keep pressing hard on that button. Yeah, hopefully he'll follow up with this with more on the subject.
Well, thank you, Christine. Christine will be back in the coming weeks with another book review.
Here are the Canadian Civil Aviation Anomalies for the week of February 13th to February 17th, 2023. On February 13th, the pilots of a national air cargo Boeing 747-400 flying from Miami, Florida to Amsterdam, Netherlands, observed unusual lights moving erratically at 40,000 feet to 50,000 feet. No further information was available. Also on February 13th, a flight in the Atlantic region flying at 22:37 Zulu time reported seeing unknown flying objects. No further information was available. On February 16th, an Air Canada Boeing 787-9 flying from Vancouver, British Columbia to Toronto, Ontario, on the downwind for runway 24R at 8,000 feet, reported a lightning strike when approximately 4 nautical miles south of Toronto Pearson Airport. On February 17th, a Canadian North ATR 42-500 flying from Fort McMurray, Alberta to Yellowknife, Northwest Territories on approach for runway 34, reported 2 white lights approximately 3,000 feet above them and 10 nautical miles northwest of the airport, moving in a circular pattern. The pilots advised that the lights were still visible as they continued their approach all the way to the ground. There was no known traffic in the area. There was no impact on operations, and all flights proceeded to their destinations without further incident.
Well, that's our podcast for this week. Please share, follow, and subscribe and do all those good things to help spread the word about UFO Talker. And until next time, this is Michael Ryan. Keep watching the skies.
You have been listening to the UFO Talker. If you have any questions or comments on this episode, you can email us at ufotalker@bell.net or visit our website at ufotalker.ca. You can support UFO Talker by using the Buy Me a Coffee app with links on our website and in the show notes. We appreciate every listener. Thank you for your support. This has been a Michael Ryan production. 30.